MSU Today is online at SpartanPodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with MSU Faculty Athletics Representative to the Big Ten and NCAA, Michael Casavana, who is also a renowned hospitality business prof in the Broad College at MSU.
An extraordinary faculty member who's viewed as a great teacher, has written a lot of very important work for the hospitality industry, and is also an entrepreneur. So, Mike, I think that sort of is a way of saying you're a renaissance person for the 21st century, and we do appreciate all you've done to try to steer intercollegiate athletics.
Well, thank you.
You know, they're big issues, and then there are some of the things that people don't see that are really critical to the success of our student athletes. So if you were to think about this period of time you've gone through, I don't know how many athletic directors or presidents, so you can sort of count for us.
Well, 4 presidents and 7 athletic directors.
What does that say about our jobs? I don't know.
Well, what it says is there was a period of time of great instability in the world of athletic directors because you're, what, the 18th or 19th athletic director, mm-hmm. and I'm the 20th president.
Right.
So actually, the university has had more presidents than athletic directors. But in this period of time, Mike's been able to have to deal with lots of turmoil. If you think about this period of time and you think about intercollegiate athletics, what have been some of the biggest changes?
I think most of the biggest changes have been in the academic area, mostly in the academic reform, and also trying to treat student-athletes more like the regular student body where possible. I think the student-athlete welfare became a major issue in the last decade for sure. I think a lot of the rule changes that have come about have actually enhanced the student-athlete's abilities to do better in terms of choice of majors, in terms of graduation rates, and I think also in terms of even admission standards have been increased accordingly.
If you think about some of the critics of these major academic reforms, they talked about denying access to universities for certain segments of our population because we were asking more of them in the classroom. Have you seen that as you've experienced the work at Michigan State or as you've observed elsewhere?
Well, I think the NCAA putting in a sliding scale, I think, helped in terms of having standardized test scores be weighted differently versus a high school core GPA. Whereas at one time there was more dependence on the standardized test scores, which I think do discriminate in some regards. At least it's been shown they discriminate in some regards in terms of social status. So I think it has kind of smoothed itself out in terms of a combination of the two and in terms of the weighting of the two. One of the issues that's still going forward is that the NCAA is trying to increase the core requirements coming in as incoming freshmen. And a lot of the public school systems are not able to offer enough laboratory courses or science courses to actually meet those requirements. And I think that becomes a problem. The other issue is that it's difficult to know what the public school systems know about the NCAA requirements. We often assume that once a rule is changed or requirements are changed, everyone knows those instantly. And a lot of students have been disadvantaged by the fact that the word doesn't get out well, especially in the rural communities or in smaller school systems. I think that's something that we need to work on also.
I think that reflects in terms of communication and timing of implementation, not necessarily what we're doing.
Correct.
And oftentimes, I think if you were to observe even the most recent NCAA reforms, having to pull the trigger very quickly because it seems like you're doing something, and particularly in these 24-hour media cycles, means that you don't necessarily take the time to phase the implementation in ways that make the most sense.
No, I agree with you, and part of that brings embarrassment to the association also, especially when you have to withdraw or back off of a proposal that went through very quickly through the system, where the student-athletes get excited and think there's a gain there, and the athletic administrators think maybe it's not so much of a gain as it could be done in a different way. And then, of course, the presidents may take some action that indicates that they support one side or the other. I think it does become problematic.
I think some of the contemporary conversations that are taking place right now that have evolved over time, when we talk about the definition of amateurism, we talk about pay for play, full cost of attendance, commercialization of sport as it is. What's your perspective of the definition of student athlete and the ideal that it's students competing for their university rather than a professional sports model? And, you know, as you think through that, there's been changes that have been made in the Olympic structure while intercollegiate athletics continues I believe, to provide great opportunities for young men and women to look at careers, whether it be in professional sports, but in most cases in other areas. What's your perspective of that term, student-athlete?
Well, I'll probably old school, probably be accused of that, but I really thought, and when I went to school, for example, an athletic scholarship was a reward for participating in your sport and also giving you the opportunity to get an advanced education. I don't dislike the Olympic model because I think that's fine when there's no school involved, and if they can offer a financial incentive, that's different. But I think going to school, receiving your scholarship, and all the other benefits that go along with travel, different experiences that you get as a student athlete, I think is sufficient. And also the fact of getting a degree and moving on to other things is probably very important for most student athletes.
I think as an athletic director, you feel a responsibility to provide as many opportunities as possible. In the Big Ten Conference, we average 25 sports, which is right at the top on a national basis. And in that pursuit, it's a resource driving occupation that we're in. It's generating resources not only for compensation of individuals that lead those men and women through their tenure on campus, but it's also resources for operations for scholarships, which at Michigan State is in the $13 million range. It really becomes a challenge. And I think as you look at where our focus is, I believe it's 2% of high school basketball players receive scholarships to play in college, and then 2% of that group actually ends up in the pros. So you're talking about a very small number where this focus is on professional sports, where the rest of the population truly are getting an education, in many cases getting scholarships, where they don't have to get a job, they don't have a debt at the end of that. And it's, I think there's a lot to be appreciated from the intercollegiate athletic experience.
No, I agree, and that's part of the reason why I think some people are opposed to having clauses in coaches' contracts where they are rewarded for graduation rates or maybe for GPA, when really it should be the faculty that are just maybe not, but at least there's
that. It's a team effort.
It's a team effort, correct. There's an academic support center. And I think part of that is also part of the package that student athletes benefit by the academic services and other medical support services are superior. And I think that's something that you don't get as a normal student. And that's also an advantage. Most of the benefits of those are not measured as part of the compensation or part of the scholarship. And so I think that's another concern student athletes ought to look at.
Well, even the health insurance alone, if you think about what else is involved beyond sort of what people think about as paying for tuition, there's housing and room and board involved. There's also, as you say, a lot of meals are provided that if you were a regular student, you'd have to pay for those meals, but they're part of the package of support for student athletes. Medical care,
right,
is superb, and I think it should be. I'm not questioning that as much as it has an economic value.
Yeah, I think most people overlook that value. That's part of the problem. They say, all I'm getting is my scholarship. The university is benefiting from my presence on the floor, on the court, in the pool, and that's bringing money to the university, but I don't see that. But like I said, I think that the analysis needs to be done in a more macro level. I think we have a lot of student athletes that go on to advanced degrees also, which I don't know that that's really reflected in much of the statistics. Most people focus on the graduation rates, and actually the graduation rates are measured in such a tight metric that if someone graduates one day or one semester beyond what the NCAA and the Big Ten consider a six-year horizon, they're considered as never having graduated, where probably that's not true. And if we look at the exhausted eligibility statistic of those student athletes who play their full 4 years, we have almost a 90% graduation rate on those students. So I think a lot of it is part of the measurements, part of the metrics. I know as a coach, I always felt that the only student athletes that were in those measurements were student athletes who were on athletically related financial aid, whereas I felt I coached the whole team. And all the student athletes should be in the statistics, just like when we compare those statistics to the student body, it includes all students. Mm-hmm. But yet when we look at student athletes, we only include those who are on athletically related financial aid.
I've known Mike now kind of indirectly for over 30 years as a student, back to the days of Doc Howe and Jill. And
we're not going to say which one of you was the student, right?
I was the student. We'll jump around and say
Mike was the old guy with gray hair.
Yes,
yeah.
It does.
To watch Mike go from coaching gymnastics, the role, probably the highest respected faculty rep in the Big Ten, sitting in meetings and watching the dynamics that take place. But it's what you do in your full-time job that I think is as interesting. And you know, the consulting work you do, the relationships that you have with some major corporations across, and you're really changing the way consumers are approaching the world today, almost to the point where wallets will no longer be necessary, and the immediacy of technology and how you buy things from vending machines to check into to different types of travel is all in your bailiwick, and it's really been an interesting process to watch the work that you do.
You want to comment on?
Yeah, well, part of the area I've been involved in the technology and hospitality industry for, well, 3 decades, and I guess I've written the main books in the area, and so I always say they're the best. My wife always reminds me, says they're the only ones that are also the worst, but but the royalties are good. But basically what happens in terms of technology, it used to be that the hospitality industry was always thought of as a high-touch industry, that you never wanted to show technology to guests. You always wanted to have a people-first type approach. But over the last 10 years or so, we really shifted more to a self-service type economy, people pumping their own gas, using their own ATMs, are now checking themselves into hotels. We're getting into the area that airlines are doing, where you can check into your hotel before you ever leave home. And on your mobile phone will be an access code that when you get to the hotel, you can go to a kiosk, enter the access code, it will dispense your room key and a small.
I just had that experience at the Final Four.
There
you
go.
I've never done that before. I never talked to a person.
That's correct.
And I'm in my room.
People like to control their own transactions, what we're finding out. And one of the things I'm working on right now is a lot of people have overlooked the fact that social networking really began with, I do a lot of work with private clubs and private club software, and that really was the first social network where you could communicate with other members in the club. You can have meetings and minutes online. You can do voting online. And as the things like Facebook and MySpace became popular, we realized that that could be extensions from the club industry to other aspects of the hospitality industry. And I think probably most people are involved with Daily Deals, whether it be Groupon or even local newspapers. And all those, the main focus is on the hospitality industry, restaurants and hotels. And one of the, the unforeseen consequences or the unintended consequences of those deals have been so popular that you get a small restaurant. I know there's one in my hometown of Williamston that has 80 seats, and they sold 1,200 Groupon certificates. And what happens with that, it's a 50% off deal. And when you make your reservations at the restaurant, of course, they don't want the 50% customers there during prime time, but they don't know you have a coupon when you make your reservation. And so what's happened is over time is that the industry has really suffered some of the consequences of that. So in order to balance that out, a lot of the operations now are using location-based technology. Where I know probably your children do it and my kids do it, is when you get somewhere, you actually check in and let people know you're there. Mm-hmm. You know, in my day and age, we never wanted anybody to know where we were, but it's unbelievable. If you go to a golf course or you go to a restaurant or you go to a hotel, you tell other people you're there, and that brings them to the location. And then the operators reward you for having said that you're there, and they either make you the mayor of the location because you're the most frequent person that's there, or if nothing else, they give you reward points. Well, one of the other issues that's happened with the industry is a lot of people now evaluate their experiences. And you go to somewhere like the Kellogg Center, and if you think you've had a bad experience, you immediately go online, and whether it be TripAdvisor or any other websites, there's a lot of them, you can say this, you know, I didn't like the facility, the people aren't friendly, the place was dirty, and that really hurts the reputation of the operation. So what some companies have done is to actually hire firms that go through and read those kinds of, and then they try to make some kind of amends with those guests who are unhappy and get them to withdraw their comments offline if possible, or at least if nothing else, try to come up with a star system or reward system where you can show that the property overall is reviewed very well by most of the guests that are there. And that's been really actually created new jobs, new employment in the industry in terms of people being digital media managers for hospitality companies.
So if we're having this conversation 5 years from now and you're imagining the hospitality industry and where it's going, what would you say about that?
Well, I think mostly what's happening is a lot of people are traveling in different capacities. They're traveling in different ways, and I think a lot of it is based on points earned. I think there'll be a lot more emphasis on affinity programs and reward programs and loyalty programs. I think in terms of the industry itself, the technology will change the experience that you have at a location. I know we're working with some companies now that are changing the ambience. For example, in a hotel room, you can decide what color you want the walls, what pictures you want on the walls. When you look outside your window, instead of seeing downtown Lansing, for example, you can dial in a nice beach scene, and that's a digital photograph that actually comes up on the wall. It looks like it's out to the three-dimensional. A lot of those changes that are happening very quickly, and one of the companies that's been leading the charges in our industry is Intel, which I think two or three years ago, didn't even know there was a hospitality industry. And of course, they're a leader in terms of making chips primarily for computers. But they've really put a lot of emphasis now into coming up with more intelligent designs. They have a set of analytics that when someone purchases something, there's actually a camera that can take a picture of you at the point of purchase. And it can basically tell approximately your age, your gender, time of day, and what you're buying. And based on that, can then reconfigure the menu or the items that are offered to you as more of a customized or personalized type approach. And what restaurants are doing in terms of using an iPad, in terms of a menu, replacing the menu with an iPad type device, or some people are calling liquid paper in the future, that you can actually then three or four people dining at the same table, maybe two or children or teenagers, would actually receive a different menu than you would based on the fact of your perceived age, gender, and time of day.
You know, just to kind of close off here, it's you look back at your career, and I hope you take time to appreciate lives that you've touched, not only in intercollegiate athletics and all the sports, but so many people across the country that are involved in operating hotels, restaurants. They all mention your name. I think you go from the student athlete right to Lady Gaga's father,
yes,
who was a student of yours at one time. So it's all all good, and we appreciate so much what you do to push Michigan State out across the country.
One of the shocking instances in terms of education is when someone comes up to you and says, "My mother says hello." And I say, "Who was your mother?" She said, "Well, she was in your class a few years back." But if it ever gets to the point where the grandchildren come up, then I know I've been there too long.
Well, you've made the world a better place and Michigan State a better place.
Well, thank you.
You can never be there too long if you stay at the cutting edge of your discipline.
Well, thank you.
That was MSU Broad College professor Michael Casavana talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luanna Simon. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. In a moment, Simon and Hollis return to discuss the Michigan turnaround plan with Business Leaders for Michigan CEO Doug Rothwell. This is MSU Today.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
And for more MSU Today, visit us on the web at MSUtoday.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Here's Michigan State University President Luanna Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Doug Rothwell. Doug is the CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan.
Well, it's our pleasure to welcome Doug Rothwell, who's the CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan. You've had a distinguished career in the private sector and in government, and you're one of those wise heads that people always turn to, particularly in the most difficult and complex times, to try to think through not only big visionary ideas, but also the practical public policy necessary to implement them. So, Doug, first of all, thanks you for the many contributions you've made to the state of Michigan. So we're just delighted to have you here.
Well, I replay a compliment many times over, Madam President. I mean, it's just the work that you have done here at the university is just phenomenal, and the role that this university is playing in helping the state is terrific, and we appreciate you being on our Business Leaders for Michigan board.
I learn a lot, and I will warn you, I know you've been on Paul W.'s show a lot and Frank's, and we're trying to ease into that marketplace at WJR. So they're
not afraid yet at all.
Right.
And we've had Paul W. on our program, so you follow in a distinguished set of leaders.
That's great.
We had a great conversation with him. as we thought about the role of business leaders and sort of where we've been and actually where we've come, which has been a long way in a relatively short period of time, politicians tend to take credit for good news and believe bad news is someone else's problem. Business leaders, I think, has charted a vision for Michigan, set out some steps, and really had a very transparent report card to the people about these are the things we think need to happen, and here's where we are, and here's some things we're rethinking as a result of just being a learning organization. So you want to comment on two or three of those highlights?
Well, you know, we're a very fact-based organization, and I think that's what's so refreshing about how we do our work. And one of the things that we've done, as you know, the last year is we've spent a lot of time trying to identify, you know, what is it that the world needs that Michigan's good at and we're, in fact, maybe even better at than a lot of other places. And some of the things we've identified align really well with the work here at the university. For example, we have identified our natural resource base in Michigan as being just absolutely critical. And if you look around the world, the demand for natural resources is just exponentially increasing. You think of our geographic location as a second area we focused on. And why is that important? Well, it's because of the dramatic growth in the shipment of goods and products. And you look at the supply chain expertise here at the university that fits in with that. And, you know, then you look at the more traditional area, like the growth of our automotive industry, which we kind of take for granted, but only 10% of the world has access to personal mobility. And you look at the engineering talent that's here. That these are what's so exciting about this work is that these are all assets we have. And all we have to do is just align our work and our focus a little bit more. And we believe great things can happen for Michigan.
I think I was in a conversation actually in Washington first part of the week about the effect that the opening of the Panama Canal will have on the eastern part of the United States, with now permitting these large super tankers, container ships, to dock in Miami or New York instead of always on the West Coast. So it's going to dramatically change the transportation pattern of the country, of global commerce. And again, Michigan could be well positioned to be a player in this new world.
Well, we really would be. And you talk about new developments on the East Coast because of the Panama Canal. Halifax, Canada is going to be developing deep water port facilities because many of the American ports are simply either landlocked or overly congested. And what's the quickest way to get goods and products from Halifax into the middle part of North America? It's really through Detroit. And then on top of that, you look at the congestion around Chicago, which has been the traditional Midwest gateway. And between their railroad congestion, their highway congestion, their airports are landlocked and overcapacitized. Michigan has an opportunity here to really be not replacing Chicago, but an alternative gateway to the Midwest. And the good thing about logistics as an industry is that it provides a lot of jobs at all levels. Mm-hmm. So it's not a job producer that's just for those with, you know, advanced scientific degrees. And it's why it's so important for a state like Michigan to embrace it.
You know, I grew up in Michigan, spent most of my life here. As you look at city versus state, you look at regions and borders that are built, how challenging is it to pull everybody on board in the same direction where you're talking about the city of Detroit, you're talking about the west side of the state of Michigan, places that are up north, of course, right here in mid-Michigan. There appear to be a lot of individual regional dynamics that come into play that sometimes, in my opinion at least, counter what we're trying to accomplish on a statewide level.
Yeah, you know, I think that if you look back historically of the last, you know, 50 years or so, I would agree with you. I think that those divisions have actually been maybe the biggest impediment to Michigan's growth. And it's been on a variety of levels, whether it's labor management, regional divisions, political divisions. And other states that have succeeded have been able to suppress those divisions when it comes to creating jobs. They still have fights. They still have different disagreements, but they work better when it comes to job production. And, you know, with our Michigan turnaround plan, which is a lot of what we're talking about here today, is, you know, a lot of it is really a to-do list for government. And we've had some great success with those changes. But a part of it has to do and depends on the ability of people to come together. And I think Michigan is getting better at that because of the hardships we've gone through these last few years. But we have to be mindful that we're in a global world and other places may do it a little better than we do, and we got to keep working at it.
So as you look at, you know, we try to attract students not only from the state of Michigan but across the globe to Michigan State. Ann Arbor does pretty much the same thing. And our aspirations are to send them off onto great jobs. I think part of our challenge is keeping those educated students in the region. How does the state go about creating the type of environments that have been built in Chicago, in Atlanta, as these attractive pools for young, well-educated individuals to percolate, I guess, in the state of Michigan?
Well, it really takes work on two fronts. I mean, first, we have to create enough good-paying jobs in fields that kids find attractive. And part of it is that we have some of them now that unfortunately have image issues. I mean, the automotive sector in particular, I joke all the time and say, if you want to work for the most high-technology industry in the world, you better join the auto industry. But kids don't always see it that way. They see it in the old-school way of being a kind of a manufacturing-oriented kind of sector. And so that's partly a branding issue that we've got to work on, particularly here in Michigan. The other part of it, though, is that, you know, we have to recognize that our cities are very important to our future. And we as a state, I think part of those divisions we've had in the past has been Detroit versus Michigan, cities versus suburbs. And again, we are getting better at it, but we're not there yet. And, you know, part of the solution will eventually have to be, I think, the way we even look at governance in Michigan. We have 3,000 units of government, probably, 1,000 too many. And the reality is that we're going to have to look hard at how we govern ourselves, which enables these cities to be able to thrive more in the future.
But you really almost have to get everybody at the table at the same time. You need these young, educated folks coming out
sure.
to understand that you want to build an amazing place for them to live where there are jobs. And it's almost the chicken and the egg kind of theory of it all has to happen at the same time.
You have to work on all fronts at the same time. And they're really the one thing we've learned in our work is there is no silver bullet that's going to fix these problems. We have to work on creating jobs that are based on assets that we have in our state that we can be good at. We have to do better at the structure of government so that we focus and prioritize the limited resources we have better to fix some of the issues that you talked about, and we have to deal with culture. We have to encourage people slowly but surely to start to feel comfortable having their neighbor next door be part of the solution rather than working in these silos that we have in the past. And, you know, again, those are easier said than done, but I think a lot of it is the work that, you know, we're just talking about here on this show is getting people aware that these are so important.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about Chicago for a moment now our students are going to Chicago, there were a set of pioneering students probably a decade or two ago who thought Chicago was the great adventure. They went to neighborhoods that were not well established. Mm-hmm. And they helped settle, you know, that area around Wrigleyville and Lincoln Park and some things that we take for granted now weren't always like that. And now they're moving into other parts of the city and they're, you know, in neighborhoods where they can afford housing and there's a few things but not everything and they're going to grow and develop. I think the challenge that we have, and I think one of the things that Business Leaders for Michigan has taken on through a variety of communication strategies, how we get to people to believe that we're serious now about creating this kind of bright and stable and growing dynamic future in our cities. Mm-hmm. Because our students who are leaving, your son soon, mm-hmm. like that kind of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. They want to be part of something very vibrant. They want to be able to experience different ethnic enclaves. They want to sort of live in a different way from the suburbia of their family, and just same way that we wanted to live, I wanted to live in someplace other than a small town.
I think you're dead on. I mean, TR's he's a sophomore on campus, and he says, Dad, when I'm done, where should I go? Should I go to Denver, Chicago, or Atlanta? And I said, Detroit. And he's like, why Detroit? And I said, you can make a difference. And he's like, well, I can't make a difference by myself. So it's getting that collection of kids to make the difference together, and how do we get there? I think that's the direction I've offered up to Governor Snyder, and we've had some great conversations about you've got folks like Tom Izzo, you've got folks, the Brady mm-hmm. Hoke. How do we take people like that to engage business, to develop that whole thing and sell it? Tom Izzo is the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. He's a person who loves this place and you know, has lived in every peninsula we've had. So, you know, how do you take folks like that? How do you instill that? And what's the game plan? I think that's the pieces that you're putting together in a tremendous way.
Yep.
And use those assets. He's one of our natural resources.
Well, let me give you one idea. The thing that we're doing as an organization is we're doing that with folks that have left the state that are now executives in other areas. So people that once lived here, worked here, grew up here, that now are CEOs in their own right outside of Michigan. We're engaging to say, you know, first, let us tell you about our story. And second, why don't you be part of the solution? Mm-hmm. And so we have actually some of these folks saying, you know, I'm willing to think about making an investment back home. I'm willing to get involved in projects. I'm willing to talk up my home state. And so, but you know what has been a problem in the past has been we didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think so much of what we're dealing with right now is we're starting to turn around our economy. It's starting to look real. We are dealing with the serious problems that Michigan has had for years. And until you start to do that, it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. Now I think we're starting to believe. And if we believe, we can get others to believe. And so that'll eventually, I think, solve the issue you're talking about where our kids, you know, aren't thinking of Michigan. Well, heck, half of it is because we didn't believe in Michigan.
Right.
And so that we're rubbing off on them.
Mm-hmm. I would say, and I would reinforce Doug's view. I mean, if you look at us, our students, and you take them when they walk in the door, 75% of them will say that they want to stay in Michigan.
No question.
I mean, and they're ready. And then they, by the time they get to seniors, you ask them the question, are there real good places for you to be in Michigan? Do you think Michigan has a future that you want to take a quote, risk on? And that number drops. And I think that's our responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I think too often this conversation is blamed the young people for somehow not being loyal. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the aftermaths of the auto industry question in our state is that people believe that loyalty may not be the same, may not be valued the same way in the future now because of the people who lost jobs, all the dislocation that happened mm-hmm. with the automobile companies as it was through their lifetime. So we've really got to rebuild trust that we are a place that can grow and develop, and we'll have our bumps, and not everybody will get what they want, and there'll be tough times, but we get together moving forward. I think Doug's leadership, business leaders from Michigan, has been a voice for this, not because it is a business voice, I should say this. There are people around the table who are business leaders, but the conversations that I've been a part of are all about what we can do to make everybody in Michigan better, not just to make business better. And Doug, I want to sort of push that out in a direct way, because I know that one of the things that has been, you know, rippling through the system is the business tax was the first thing. Therefore,
sure.
The only thing that business leaders is really interested in is sort of something for them. And I think that's really far from the truth. And again, I think we need to sort of deal with that directly and give you a chance to respond to it.
Well, I think that it really is in our name. I mean, I really take pride in the fact that we're called business leaders for Michigan, not for business per se. Not that there's anything wrong with being for business, but we really look at what Michigan needs first to grow its economy and create jobs for people. And a good example of that is the conversation we were having, you know, off air just before we came on about higher education. You know, we are actively advocating for increased funding for higher education. And why? Well, sure, there's a business interest there because we know we're going to need over 1 million kids with some level of college education here in the next decade or so. But it's also a people issue. I mean, we have disinvested in our students that are trying to go to college by $1 billion over the last 10 years. There's been a direct dollar-for-dollar cost shift that then has gone on the backs of kids in terms of increased student debt. University has done a great job maintaining costs and done what they can to mitigate those costs. But at some point, you can't go any further. And so we as an organization are really probably alone out there right now with the university president saying, hey, this has got to stop. We got to turn this thing around. And I think it is a good indication where not that we need the other business groups. They need to be watchful of the regulatory and the things that do affect business. But I think we tend to look at things a little more longer term and strategically that hopefully is filling a void that was not being filled in the past.
Well, I think the people around the table see the need for more jobs and see the need for people with different skills for those jobs. And that's been very much a part of the conversation. It's not that everybody needs to get a four-year degree or everybody doesn't need to even get a degree from from a university with a brand name. It is about the fact that we need more high-tech line workers for the utility industries, and we need very skilled tool and die makers for the automobile industry. And right now, those skills are, for the complexity of the equipment, require people who probably have something beyond high school.
That's right.
And we seem in this state not to be able to get that message across. It's very frustrating.
Well, and, you know, I was talking about this earlier today. I mean, one of the things we're seeing come out in the data right now is kind of this growing gap between, you know, the most highly educated individuals and the lowest educated individuals in the workforce. And that gap is widening. And I'm like you, Madam President. I don't know what more we have to kind of, you know, demonstrate to show that there is a necessity for people to get more education. And just as you said, it doesn't always have to be a four-year degree, but it does have to be probably something beyond high school, and certainly some technical background would be, you know, even more helpful. That gap is going to continue to grow if that doesn't change.
Lansing alone has, I think at the last count, the meeting I was at, between 250 and 300, quote, high-tech jobs. Some of those can be filled by people right out of high school who have a capacity to learn and want to learn new skills. And a couple of the web-based companies will teach them because the way in which they want to deal with those skills. Others require, you know, a four-year degree plus in order to fill. But there are plenty of jobs right now.
Right. I heard 80,000 jobs open in Michigan, but those requiring skills that unfortunately are not in the workforce right now. And so here you have a situation where we're, you know, celebrating getting down to 8.5% unemployment, which is still too high. But think how much lower it could be if we could have filled those 80,000 jobs. That's the challenge that we have in our state. It's not just a Michigan challenge. It's a national problem. But it's particularly acute in Michigan because the kind of assets that we have that we talked about earlier really lend themselves disproportionately to having more people with technical and educated background skills. And so if we can't produce that, we're going to have a problem. You know, the other thing we just to mention is that, you know, we talked about the kids migrating different places and all. I mean, we can't even fill those jobs most likely in the next 10 years with just in-state students because of our demographics. So the need to even bring in out-of-state students to Michigan universities is critical, and we should not, you know, ostracize universities for doing that. We should celebrate universities doing that.
Because I think actually the data that have been produced by some independent folks would suggest that we actually keep a higher proportion of our in-state students than many other places. Mm-hmm. And though we don't keep everybody, and there was a time we probably kept a much higher proportion than the rest of the states, we're still above average in keeping our students in Michigan. And I'm really excited about the work that's happening in Grand Rapids and in terms of working to make that a really cool city. It's not necessarily the view of Grand Rapids by many people, but the downtown is vibrant. They're doing lots of very interesting things. We're finding that our students are living downtown and working at some of the companies in the ring instead of living in the ring and going downtown. Detroit, I'm excited about the prospects of Detroit.
You know, it kind of comes back to, what is the message and how do you execute it? And what does the small business owner, the CEO, the person on the street that wants to make a positive change, how do you take all those resources and that energy and get it moving in the same direction? And so much of our task right now is focused on what our job is and what the task at hand is. But there's a lot of people who want to make a difference in this state, and it's the work that you're doing. Just has to continue and has to push, and the success is coming.
Well, it is, and I think you said it perfectly, which is right now the best thing we can do is to let people know that there's a genuine turnaround underway in this state. Yes, we went through a decade that was tough, but we're tired of looking at our feet. It's hard to start for us to look forward, and we can look forward with optimism because we do have the assets that other states don't have and assets that are here today. We don't have to go bring them in from somewhere else. They're here right now. If we simply, as a community of citizens, work harder at focusing our energy around those assets that we have and build them, there's a very bright future for Michigan.
So if we're having this conversation 5 years from now, And when you were imagining this Michigan based on the new Michigan plan, what would be some of the highlights? We've touched on it, but I want to sort of let you repeat it again and reinforce it.
So let's think of a state that, first of all, in terms of the basics, has its regularly passes budgets on time without any news accounts of it. That has a competitive cost environment that isn't the cheapest place to do business, but a place that businesses find very friendly. A culture where business is welcomed. And we fight with each other, but when it comes time to growing jobs, we're all in it, all in just one voice. Some of the industries and sectors that you can see growing, what about all the land around Metro Airport down in Southeast Michigan that becomes developed and is a hub of distribution and transportation activity? A place that's known as being the engineering capital or engineering village of the world because of our preponderance of engineers. Think about a place that is able to utilize its natural resources in a sustainable way to create jobs. A place that can feed the world, if you will. A place that, for example, can have a higher education marketplace, not just a higher education system, where we have loads of out-of-state students coming to our campuses and more kids staying here because of the jobs that are being created. That can all happen in a 5 or 10 year period with focus and energy.
And we want to thank business leaders. We probably should say that that one of the great leadership pieces with business leaders that we sort of take for granted now because name changes mean something is that there were a group of people who are in this organization, including automobile leadership, that had a pretty much a Southeast Michigan focus. And they were wise enough to say that for all of us to grow, we needed to have a statewide focus, not simply a regional focus. And we had to get out of this what I would call zero-sum game mentality and think about it for Michigan. Mm-hmm. And so business leaders, which grew out of a lot of discussion, came to the point of view that there was an attitude change for all of us, for business leaders,
yep.
And now I think for community leaders, for governmental leaders, that we have to get out of this zero-sum game mentality about one of us against the other.
Yep.
And that, I think, has been one of the key hallmarks of your leadership, Doug, has been to try to not simply get the specifics that you've been talking about, but try to get this attitude change away from this old way of thinking.
I think we've made a difference, Luana, in terms of I don't hear as much of the east-west divide in Michigan as we used to. And mm-hmm. I think I don't hear even as much of the big business, small business divide that I used to. And I think that the work we've done has been part of that. And actually, you'll get a kick out of this. So that athletic director down in Michigan, Dave Brandon, actually had a big part of helping us do that. But I appreciate your thoughts because I think it has made a difference.
And I would even say that Dave Brandon and Mark Hollis talk regularly. and there are just a few occasions per year that we might differ on the desired outcome.
Yep.
And as you know, Mary Sue and I have known each other for a long time. Yep. And I think
it's a great relationship.
We're allies for Michigan, except again for a few occasions. And,
right.
And just like you said, I mean, our faculty, their faculty, the faculty at Wayne State with Allen are all going to submit grants. And they're going to be competitive.
Yeah, right.
And there are going to be some occasions when a team wins because there's no outcome to a game.
Yeah.
But not to be negative about athletics, those are symbols of what and help us get people to come back to Michigan. So our alums watch all of those from around the
you
world,
bet.
And you heard that, a way of connecting. But we also step beyond that, and I think that Dave's leadership, Mark, I know you've done that with a number of other things, seeing athletics not as simply the game we play, but the life we lead, and I think that's
Dave
part
of it. Dave and I collaborate much more than either of our fan bases would like to know that we collaborate, and you know, sure, we compete on the golf course, we compete in our stadiums and arenas, but both of us compete for the state of Michigan, I think, in very positive ways, and we'll continue to do so. Following the footsteps of our leaders as presidents, so we believe in this place. I love the comments that you make. You know, I'm ready to fall in right behind you and believe we can accomplish what you state.
You know, though, Mark, what you said is really symbolic for our state because I think the more that Michigan State and Michigan do well, it's kind of like Grand Rapids and Detroit. You know, we're stronger if both of you are doing well than if not.
No question. And you know, we believe that in everything. When you look at the Lions, the Tigers, the Wings, The Pistons, it's sports are a reflection of our society, and we are in this together, and we'll make this a better place. Michigan's a wonderful place to live.
Great. And again, we appreciate your leadership, Doug. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
That was business leaders for Michigan CEO Doug Rothwell talking with Michigan State University President Luana Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. This is MSU Today.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com. And for more MSU Today, visit us on the web at MSUtoday.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association. Your personal network for life.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
This is an association of the three research universities in Michigan to really collaborate on a deeper level than we have in the past and highlight for ourselves and for the region and for the nation the strength in technology, innovation, new research, investment that we think is going to help change the Michigan economy.
That's University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman.
The mission of the URC is no less than to help transform the Michigan economy and to make this a vibrant place that young people will want to come and stay, that businesses will want to be in, because we are a place where a lot is happening and we have the brain power for the new economy. It's here. It's in Michigan. We just need to tap it.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
So Michigan is vibrant. Michigan has all these things, and we want to signal that to the entire world.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's been about a year now since we've had Rachel Rourke on the program, and we've been talking about the Green Street Fair, but it's that time again. Rachel is an organizer for this year's Green Street Fair, which is the fifth annual already, May 4th through 6th in lovely downtown Plymouth, Michigan. Rachel, great to have you back on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The fifth year already. Where does the time go? For our listeners who may not be familiar with the fair, and there aren't many who aren't, what was the purpose behind the fair? What are the goals and objectives?
Well, basically, this is an all-green, eco-friendly festival that is outdoors. It's free to the public. And we are bringing together all kinds of companies, artists. We have workshops. So people can find out what's the latest in green products and services, and also nonprofit organizations.
Well, last year you had over 90,000 people in attendance, over 200 exhibits. What are we looking at for this year?
We are looking at, bigger and better all the time. We have new things we're learning about, new companies coming to showcase their goods. This event, we really say, is kind of for the green curious, kind of for folks that are coming to find out, why do I want a rain barrel? Or, why do I maybe want an electric car? It's kind of a good avenue for people to walk around, have a good time, and still, you know, learn a few things at the same time. We want people to bring out the whole family. This event was started by a group of moms. We all have kids, too, and know you got to keep them happy.
My guest is Rachel Rourke, who's an organizer of this year's fifth annual Green Street Fair, May 4th through 6th in beautiful downtown Plymouth, Michigan. You have so many of these educational exhibits, et cetera. I think we mustn't neglect to mention the great entertainment that you have throughout the Green Street Fair. And you call your entertainment stage the Eco Beats Entertainment Stage. But a little bit about some of these artists who will be performing throughout the fair.
Well, we have a wonderful mix of a lineup, some great local favorites that people love, and as well as some bigger names like the Verve Pipe. We're very excited to have joining us on Saturday, May 5th. And we'll have, everything from, you know, kind of blues to reggae and everything in between. So all of that's free. You can come down, have lunch, enjoy the music. And it keeps it fun and up-tempo.
Well, now that we've got all of our listeners ready to just toot on down to Plymouth for the Green Street Fair, what are your hours? What are the times and what are the dates again, Rachel?
Sure. It's May 4th, 5th, and 6th, which is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And Friday, it runs from noon to 7, Saturday, 10 to 7, and Sunday, 10 to 5. And for more info, it's easiest to just go to greenstreetfair.com. You can also find us on Facebook, where we're posting lots of fun, new, exciting highlights all the time.
One nice thing about Facebook, a lot of the kids will see that on their Facebook pages and then say to their folks, hey, this is something the family needs to do.
That's true. Yeah, a lot of the kids end up bringing mom and dad. So that is cool. This generation is, you know, all about being green and getting mom and dad to go along with it.
Well, you've got a lot of great sponsors for the fair, sponsors that have been with you for all 5 years, including WJR 760 AM.
Absolutely. So glad to have you guys join us and be part of this event. It's really a great time, and it's wonderful, we think, for all of Metro Detroit, which really is a great draw. It's not just, you know, the Plymouth area. So we invite everybody to come on out.
Well, and I would only echo what Rachel has said. I've been talking with Rachel Rourke, one of the organizers of the Green Street Fair, May 4th through 6th in downtown Plymouth. Rachel, I hope you get a huge turnout this year, and thank you again for being on Greening the Great Lakes.
Thank you so much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.